This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 99. This episode is brought to you by Animoto, and right now is the perfect time of year to hop on with Animoto because it's the end of the year. You know, you can put together a slideshow of your best photos from the year. One that I'm doing right now for my wife is I'm putting together a slideshow of all our best family pictures, even if they're just cell phone stuff, but I want to put together a really nice slideshow for my wife. I think we're going to make that a Christmas Eve tradition, so a great way to use Animoto. You can get started at animoto.com/improve, and that'll give you a discount on what is already an awesome deal. So we thank Animoto for their support of the podcast. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. Today, you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world. Some are beginners, some are more advanced, but we're all here to talk about the photography that we love. And to talk about all of it today is my friend Darren Meller.
Hey, Jim, how are you doing today?
Awesome. I'm excited for Christmas. We're having a five-year-old and a three-year-old in the house. It's hard not to be excited about Christmas.
It's such an exciting time of the year. I remember being young in those days, counting down from when Santa was going to come. I'd love to go back to those times. It's one of the best times of the year, hands down.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, Darren, I have good news for you, and that is that we have our very first question submitted by a listener directed to Darren. So let's go to that one.
All right.
Hi, guys. My name is Sarah, and I live right across the river from Darren in Omaha, Nebraska. So first of all, I just wanted to thank you guys so much for all the work you've done on these podcasts. I've listened to every single episode, and I've really learned a ton. So my question is about upgrading gear. I love the look of lighting landscapes, and I really want to start integrating these into my portfolio. I have a Nikon D3100 that I bought 4 years ago, and I've definitely outgrown, and I've been thinking about upgrading in the next year, possibly to the 7100. I've heard you guys mention that you're not really happy with the wide-angle lens options for crop sensor cameras. So my problem is that I run an Etsy shop selling my photography, and while I've been more successful than I thought I would be in the last year, that my shop has been open, it would probably take me 2 years worth of profits to pay off a full-frame camera and wide-angle lens. Would you recommend getting the wide-angle lens to use with the D3100 or 7100, or possibly waiting a little longer to upgrade the camera body instead? If I wanted to get into more wide-angle shots, and what lens would you choose if you do recommend that option? Thanks again for all your help. I'm getting some flash gear for Christmas, and I'm looking forward to taking a flash photography course to help me get started. Thanks again.
Okay, so she's on a Nikon D3100. That's a crop sensor camera, and she's looking for something wide-angle, but really just a path to take with her upgrade process. She has an Etsy shop where she's selling her photography that's making a little bit of money to justify it, but, you know, this is a big expense for her. So, Darren, what kind of path would you suggest?
Well, I'm going to tiptoe it a little bit easily on here because I'm a Canon shooter, but looking at the camera she's peering at right now, I think the D7100 would be a good move. The only other camera that comes to mind in the full frame market from the Nikon side of things would be the 810 or the 750, but you're talking about a whole lot more money to be spending there. And if she invests more in the lens and gets the D7100, I think that that's going to lead her down a better path because she can always marry her lenses and then outgrow the camera body and hawk it on eBay to where her shop is able to pay for that full frame body down the road.
Okay. So you're thinking D7100 and probably like a Tokina 11 to 16 for a lens?
Yeah, I was thinking the Tokina 11 to 16. When I first mentioned the name Tokina to my dad, who's been shooting film, he kind of cringed because that name wasn't so popular back in the film days. But now that we've actually had time to take a look at that lens, and that's one of the ones you recommend, right, Jim?
Yes.
Yep. As far as sharpness and everything goes, I think she's going to be really satisfied with that lens. And then once she's able to pay off that camera body and actually make some money from her work that she has with her current setup, the D7100 and the Tokina lens, she can always branch out to get a full frame body to get that actual focal length for what the lens is designed for Tokina. Because when it comes down to the crop sensor lineup with lenses, I do agree that they are kind of subpar right now. So eventually I think she'll grow into it by going the less expensive route.
Yeah, I think you're right. I wouldn't. There's always this allure of a full frame camera if you haven't shot one. And you know, once you make the switch and you start shooting full frame, there are some things that are really nice. There are also drawbacks, and we've talked about that lots of times on the podcast. But I would love to see people in this particular situation, you know, where going to a full frame camera would be a huge expense for her, to just drop it, just kind of kill that, that's ever going to happen, and just find a good crop sensor, a good fit for you in the crop sensor world. So on Nikon, you're really limited on what you're going to do. You basically have two choices here. Tokina 11-16, it's about a $500 lens, or the Nikon 10-24. I can't recommend the Nikon 10-24. It's more expensive than it should be for how poor of optics it really is. Sharpness is and you know, things like chromatic aberration, the aperture on the lens, all that, it's hard to get excited about that lens. And so I wouldn't recommend that. And so I'd probably recommend the Tokina 11-16. Good lens, not great lens, but if you're on Nikon crop sensor, what else are you going to pick? You know, there just aren't a whole lot of options for you. But since she's just starting and doesn't have a huge investment into stuff, I might say, if we're looking for an upgrade path, that if she wants to do this today, maybe look at something like the Canon 7D Mark II with Canon's new crop sensor wide angle lens, the 10-18 millimeter lens. It's so cheap. What is it, like $200 or $300? Very inexpensive lens, and it's getting great reviews. I have not personally played with it, but getting great reviews for a very inexpensive wide angle lens on a crop sensor body. You're going to save money by staying crop sensor, and the 7D Mark II is not a cheap camera. It's a really nice camera, but staying crop sensor means you don't have to spend $2,000 on a lens. So I don't know, that could be a good upgrade path for her as well.
And I would be more than willing to drive over across that river to Omaha to visit her and show her how to use that Canon camera should she make the switch. So I think that would even be an even bigger bonus.
Yeah, absolutely. You got Darren. He'll wear a bow and show up on your doorstep on Christmas to show you how to use this camera. Just if you get the camera, you're committed, right, Darren?
Yep, I'm committed as long as it's in. A Canon.
Bow on the forehead. He will be on your doorstep for a personal lesson. Let us know if it happens. We will get Darren over to your house. All right. So, you know, there are a lot of different options and different ways she could take it. Another one is since she's shooting landscapes, you may look at something like a Sony. Sony is doing some really neat things. They're less expensive bodies, not cheap, but they're less expensive than some of the professional Canon and Nikon. So that would be an option to look at. And for landscape photography, I think they're a good choice. The focus system, the slowness of some of their models, some are very quick, but some are slow, it would be things that would turn me away from shooting it for portraits. But if you're just doing landscape photography, that's another option to look at. But, you know, if this is we're looking longer, you know, longer story in when she's going to purchase, then I think there's good reason to wait around until February or March before making a choice at this point. We've heard, I mean, there are always rumors of new stuff going up, new cameras coming out and stuff. Those are always going to be there. But the type of things that I'm hearing for the, you know, probably the CES timeline, I think it's in early February is CES. And there are always some major camera and photo gear announcements around that time of the year. So it may be worth waiting too. You know, if there's a big expense and you want to make sure you're going to get something latest and greatest so you can have that excitement at least for a little while until it gets replaced, it may be worth waiting until then. I think we're going to see some really cool things.
I'm excited for seeing what they're going to come up with. And my prediction, and I'm going to stick with this prediction right now, is that we're going to see Canon do something in the full frame lineup, since Nikon just recently did after Photokina. And we're going to see the reverse happen on the Nikon side, where we see something come out on the crop sensor side of things for Nikon and have something not come out on the full frame side. So I'm very excited for CES 2015.
Yeah, I'm wondering if Nikon can come out with something to compete with that 7D Mark II. That's a neat... I mean, that's a pretty powerful looking camera. The feature set on that is incredible. I'd love to see if Nikon can compete.
Yes, I think that it would be a real admirable fight, and I'd like to see who would come out on top. But that's why they're the market leaders, because when one does one thing, the other ones follow suit, and they just kind of are always neck and neck. And that's the fun thing about shooting Canon and Nikon at this point in time.
Yep. Well, if you are picking up a new camera, or anytime you pick up a new camera, we have a list for you today of some things you can do to set up a brand new camera. Now, we're not going to talk about any of the obvious stuff like turn it on, put it in battery today. We wanted to talk about some of the features that you may not know are in your camera at all, especially if you're coming from a lower model line of camera before. So, you know, if this is your first major upgrade, you're really going to want to listen to this carefully. If you use new cameras all the time, then you really want to listen to this, because I can't tell you how many times I've picked up a new camera and shot with completely wrong settings for a few days until I realized, oh yeah, it doesn't come by default like that. So we're gonna point out some of those things that you really got to check on when you pick up that brand new camera. Well, Darren, you get a brand new camera. What are some of the things that you run to first? What are you gonna change?
Well, one thing that I'm going to run to first is going ahead and setting up my camera to shoot in RAW, because I do have some admiration for people who shoot JPEG and have the file baked in and not have as much editing capability. But I am a RAW shooter for life, and that's one thing I'm going to do right away is make my adjustment to shoot RAW, because it does make a big difference if you plan on doing any editing to your photos.
Yeah, I'm with you. I always shoot in RAW. I think just about all professional photographers do at this point. But you know what? When I was doing the videos for the Lightroom Steel, I purchased photos from people in the improved photography community, because I wanted to, you know, kind of show off other people's work for the sale. So I bought photos from quite a few of you. I just posted on Facebook and said, hey, you know, if you have something awesome, shoot it over to me, and I'm buying photos. And several of them had shot the photos in JPEG that I picked. And I thought, ah, man, I don't know. But I worked with them in Lightroom and stuff. And after spending a couple hours, if I didn't look down at the file name, it was kind of hard to tell which was the RAW and which was the JPEG. And so, and you know, this is very different if we're talking about iPhone JPEG, where it's heavily compressed. But a full resolution in all its glory JPEG coming out of a DSLR actually has a lot of information in it. And so what I would love to do, and I don't know, maybe the results would be more dramatic than I had thought, but what I'd like to do is do a blind test of well-known photographers and put RAWs and JPEGs and TIFFs as well, and see if we can tell any differences between them. You know, mask, put a piece of tape on the screen and have people try them and see really how big of a difference we're talking about.
I think you're correct in that. I think that we would probably notice a negligible difference, and the trained eye might be able to notice a difference. But if you were able to show some elementary kids a few weeks ago the photos from your iPhone versus photos from a DSLR, and they were having trouble finding the difference, I think that we're giving RAW files a little bit too much credit. I think it would be a nice experience to test those and test them against TIFFs, and maybe even throw a DNG in there just for the fun of it.
Oh, that would be fun. All right, I'm gonna do that. I'm gonna put that together for in the next couple months, and we'll do that. You know, people who are just kind of the religion of RAW, and I always shoot in RAW. I'm not saying that, you know, that there's anything wrong with that by any means, but if you haven't shot a JPEG in a while, just do the test. Just shoot a JPEG and try to move the sliders around, and then shoot a RAW and move the sliders around. You'll see that the difference isn't nearly as big as you probably thought it was. Anyway, we're gonna switch over to RAW. I think we might as well. If you're doing any photo editing, you might as well. Another one that I always set up right away is the copyright info and the image comment. This is important if you're marketing your photography, but really for any photographer. Now, if you have an entry-level camera, you know, your Nikon D3200, well, I can't confirm for certain that camera doesn't have it, but you know, the Canon Rebels Nikon D3200s, I usually don't see this capability in them. I could be wrong on some of the newer models, but usually they don't have a way to, in the file, embed your copyright information. So when I take a picture, right in the file, in the metadata, it says Copyright Improved Photography LLC. And you're going to want to make sure you put that image comment in there so that, you know, you have that to go along with your file for copyright reasons. But also, it's cool for professional photographers, because if you put that copyright info in there, when you send your photo to a client, then the client when they upload it to Facebook, it shows that... It shows that image comment right on the screen as the text. So you know how you put up a photo and you can caption it on Facebook? It shows that image comment there. So it's like free advertising every time they put the picture up.
That's awesome. Yeah, I didn't know that it did that in that sense. I definitely have populated the copyright info with memory pixel photography on my camera. Looking at the image comments, I didn't realize that would do that. Does it do it on Pixoto from what you've seen? Because I know when we log in there, we can actually pull up what the camera settings are if the metadata was, you know, uploaded at the time of upload with Pixoto. But that's pretty darn awesome.
I don't know about Pixoto, but Facebook definitely for sure does it, because every time I do a shoot for a client and they put it up, it always says Copyright Improved Photography LLC, just like my image comment.
That's great. And also, when you're shooting for a client, one thing that's really going to matter too, because we're talking about metadata here, is setting the time. Setting the time the camera is definitely important when you pick up a new camera. It's something that I actually overlooked for 7 weeks when I was in Europe. I didn't set it for the time zone. And so when I came back and imported everything into my library, it was hectic because it was always going to be 7 hours behind. I was still in central time zone, even though I was physically in Europe taking those pictures. So make sure to set that time.
Believe me, I understand that. I shot the new Nikon D750 while I was in Iceland, and I just grabbed it out of the box right before I left and forgot to set the date and time. And so it's a pain because I was shooting with two bodies and my cell phone. I was taking videos, you know, to record for you guys to put up on the YouTube channel and just taking snaps, you know, of people there that I met and stuff. It was just fun. You know, your food at a restaurant. Look, I'm eating... you know, stewed puffin, which I didn't eat. But anyway, you're doing whatever, and you take photos with different cameras, and so then you put them all in Lightroom, and they show in chronological order, and then you have your photo from the D750 showing in like 2004, or you know, because the date hasn't been set, and so it's really annoying if you forget to set that to go back and change it on your photos.
Yeah, it can be really clunky and a real big pain in the butt. So after setting up those initial things, one thing that I noticed with a lot of people when they get a new camera is they're having trouble focusing. So there's different types of focus modes out there. We can use one shot. We can use continuous. They call it AI servo on Canon, and they call it the, autofocus continuous on Nikon?
Yeah, autofocus continuous, or sometimes it just shows AFC.
And if you're getting a new camera, one thing that we had Tony Northrup on the show recently, and he mentions in one of his videos that stood out to me is that, for instance, imagine that you're photographing your son or daughter playing baseball and you have it on one shot when they're up at bat. But then if you don't know this new camera very well, you're going to have less chance of shooting those shots of the little girl running down the baseline because you're going to have to flip over to AI servo. So my suggestion with a new camera, and Tony would probably agree with this, and hopefully Jim does as well, is that we need back button focus to a certain degree, because it enables you to have some personal experience with being able to switch over to your focus mode or actually use AI servo focus in a more efficient way. So what are your thoughts on that, Jim?
Yeah, I really just switch between those two. Single shot if I'm shooting any landscape, or sometimes portrait if the person's going to be mostly still, and AFC or continuous focus if we're going to do any kind of moving around kind of thing. And for the metering mode, I just always have mine on matrix metering. I just think it's, or I think it's called evaluative on camera or on Canon. Some every once in a while I switch to single shot for something. Dustin used to shoot in single shot a lot, and to me that just didn't work. I just kind of trust the camera. Most time it does well. When it doesn't, I fix it.
Yeah, I I used to use All Evaluated, but I actually changed recently. I actually went to spot metering because I found, you know, it had some better results. And then when I was shooting different subjects, though, and I was shooting backlit clients and whatnot, the sky would be blown out. So Evaluated does seem to be growing with as the cameras grow, too, because even though we may say at times we don't want the camera to be doing most of the thinking, we want to do a lot of the thinking. The cameras are getting smarter. And if how important really is back button focus if we're thinking about whether or not that's taking away from us telling the story of the photo. And that's, I think, another reason we advocate shooting with auto white balance is because that's one less thing we need to worry about in the field when trying to capture something.
Okay, so let's talk about those. Let's talk about setting your white balance and also about back button focus and how useful it really is. But before we do that, let's take just 1 second and take one of our sponsors for the episode, and that is Animoto. Animoto is a really easy way to upload your photos to the service, and they automatically put them in like a nice slideshow. This isn't just like photo, fade, photo, fade, photo. It looks really nice. It looks produced like you've actually edited it, and they have awesome music to go along with it. I'm really loving Animoto. Are you using Animoto as well at all, Darren?
I'm not using it, but a lot of the students in Proof Photography's photoclasses.com are using it, and they're loving the results that they're seeing from it. And quite honestly, from the videos that I've seen from samples and everything, it looks amazing. It does look like a professionally produced video, and what more could you ask for? Because when people are looking for quality, they're looking for those little nuances of whether it looks professional or whether it looks clunky or put together haphazardly.
All right, we're going to win you over, Darren. I'm gonna send you over a subscription here so you can work on it. You're totally going to be won over. It works really nicely. And, you know, when you have so many other things to do with editing a shoot, and you have, you know, 1,000 photos from this senior shoot, and you spent hours and hours putting them all together and getting it just right, getting every photo to look its very best, you don't also want to jump into Adobe Premiere and learn video stuff and put together a slideshow for the client. You know, you can just quickly export all your photos over to Premiere from Lightroom, and you got a nice slideshow that you can give to the client. They can use on social networking and stuff, and it's just really a beautiful solution.
I think it would be. And also, I will keep it a surprise. Hopefully she doesn't listen to this episode, but that bride who had the wedding in Maui and had the reception that I shot earlier in November in Council Bluffs, Iowa, I think I might surprise her and put together an Animoto video. I think that would just be icing on top of the cake to add to that experience, because I'm putting together a photo book for her, but how nice would it be to have a video that she and her new husband can watch together to celebrate that memory?
Yeah, it is very cool. And I've been using Animoto long before they were a sponsor of the website. In fact, I signed into my account, and I think it said it was, I can't remember when it was, years ago I've been using them. So they really do good work. Well, and if you're interested in trying out Animoto, you can do so. They have a free plan, but the paid plans really have a lot of powerful features and especially good music choices. So go ahead and check it out at animoto.com/improve. And we really thank them for their support of the podcast. All right, well, let's get back to some of these things we want to talk about setting up a camera. Now, back button focus is this thing that I have a love-hate relationship with. When I set up back button focus and I get in the habit of using it on a camera, sometimes I really do love just that workflow. So all you're doing is when you press halfway down on the shutter button where it would normally start focus, it does nothing. The focus happens when you press a button on the back of the camera. Hence back button focus. So you just press that button to do the focus, and then you only use the shutter button to fire the shot. No focus happens when you press the shutter button. And it works really well in some particular situations. You know, if you're shooting sports or something, and you know, you have a referee jumping in and out of your way, or let's say we're shooting wildlife, and there's a fox running through the weeds. Well, as you pan across the weeds following the fox, your focus is going to jump between the weeds and the fox and the weeds and the fox, and it can get very confusing. And so what you can do is you press the back button focus, just let go while the fox crosses the weeds, and then press it again if you need to when the fox is out of the weeds. Or if it's still in focus when the fox gets out of the weed, you don't have to focus again. You're already done. And so you can just press the shutter button without worrying about when you go halfway down, now it's going to have to refocus and mess it up. So there are some benefits to it. It takes a second to set up, but nice. Fortunately, we have an easy article to follow on how to do this at improvephotography.com/BBF, back button focus. So you can get it set up. Just about any camera will do this. Even the beginner cameras can do this. Essential no. A nice technique to know, especially if you're shooting like wildlife sports, something fast action like that. Yeah, it can be helpful.
I think it could be helpful in those situations. I don't think it's very essential. I mean, to be quite honest and frank, I've used it a couple times. I used it for Formula One. I've used it for, when there's a lot of movement with bald eagles, because I was noticing, like you were saying, with the fox going through the weeds, I had eagles flying in between branches, and branches were in focus, and eagle was in focus. And heck, I don't even know how many photos I threw away at the end of the day, but it could come in handy in certain situations. But it's also muscle memory, too. I always find the transition between going from back button focusing to re-enabling that operation to where you press the shutter button halfway down to actual be the trigger for focusing with autofocus. That's kind of a muscle memory thing. So it's almost like shifting gears from driving a manual transmission car to going back to an automatic and reaching for a clutch that's not there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another time that I think it can be helpful is if you're shooting a camera that doesn't have a whole lot of autofocus points, it can be nice to have back button autofocus, because there you're doing focus and recompose. You know, you're using the center focus point, holding halfway down, or the back button in this case, you're focusing anyway, and then you move the lens around, you know, to maybe you want to shoot a vertical orientation, horizontal, whatever, to shoot. But since your distance between you and the model hasn't changed, you can change and try different compositions and you don't have to mess with the focus. So if you're not using back button focus in that situation, then you've got to, you know, find the focus, take a picture, you know, focus and recompose, shoot, focus and recompose, shoot, focus and recompose, shoot. Whereas with back button focus, just do it one time and then pop, 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 pop.
And I could actually see it being used less by the lucky Nikon users out there who have more focus points. Those of us who have the Canons with 12 focus points on a full frame camera, I think that could really come in a lot more handy than someone who has multiple focus points that we're finally just seeing on the 70D and the 70 Mark II. Oh gosh, I've been waiting for that for so long. 12 focus points just hasn't been cutting it, and that's probably why back button focus probably is even a better tool when you have less focus points to work with. So I can definitely concur with that one.
Yeah. And then there are a couple other things that are just kind of quick to set. One is I always set my self timer for 2 seconds, because sometimes I use that as a way to stabilize the camera between when I press the shutter button and when the photo actually takes. So, you know, usually it's set by 10 seconds to default, because it's there so that you can take a picture and then run in with the family and go, yay, and take a picture, right? So it's like selfie mode, the self timer is. But a lot of landscape photographers use it, you know, because then you can press the shutter button, wait 2 seconds and let everything settle down, and then it takes the picture. It's really the same thing as using a cable release. Now, I find that is not necessary and makes zero difference. If your shutter speed is anything other, faster or slower, than around 1/15th of a second. So that's kind of the area where the shutter speed is so slow that is slow enough that the vibration of the mirror makes a big difference. Or the vibration of pressing the shutter button makes a big difference. If you have a really fast shutter speed, you know, it doesn't really matter how you press the shutter button. It's probably going to be sharp. If you have a really long shutter speed, like 10 seconds for a landscape or a night photo, then it really doesn't matter either, because it's going to normalize over the time of the exposure. So it matters the most around 1/15th of a second. So if you ever find yourself around there, it can be nice to use that self timer.
Yes, I agree. And back to white balance real quick. I think we can both simply say, leave it on auto. You can adjust it so quickly in Adobe Camera Raw and inside Lightroom that pretty much, unless you're doing something specialized like gel shifting or something along those lines, I always leave my white balance on auto. What do you do, Jim?
Amen. Death to the white balance. It's just one less thing to worry about. Just as easy to, in fact, it's easier to fix in post.
It is.
All right. And another one that I do on my cameras is I set my function button to control the virtual horizon. So if you're fortunate enough to have a virtual horizon in your camera, so it shows on your LCD screen on the back, it shows you if the camera is level, which landscape photographers especially use all the time, because, you know, it can be hard with a wide angle lens to tell if your horizon's exactly equal. Or exactly even. So I set that function button. It's just kind of an extra bonus button that you can set to do a bunch of different things. I set it to the virtual horizon because I use that a lot. Not every camera is going to have a programmable button. But if you have something, you know, the D7100 line, the 70 Mark II, anything just one up from the basic lines, you're going to start to see those programmable function buttons. Or if you're in like a Nikon D5200, it doesn't, if I remember right, it doesn't have a dedicated ISO button. And so you could use your function button, you could program it to be your ISO button. So whatever you find yourself using a lot that there isn't a dedicated button for, set up that function button.
That's a very good tip. And another thing that I like to do when I get a new camera, even if the memory card has not been used, I like to format the memory card in the camera. And that's the only place I will ever format my memory cards is going to be inside my camera I'm using it with.
That's right. If you've used that memory card with a different camera, even if it's a Nikon, even if it's a camera, Canon that you know, same brand, it has to be the same model. If it's not the same model, it's going to change the folder structure within the memory card. And so be sure to format the card in the new camera, not erase all images, but format it. And you're going to prevent problems with the camera locking up and with the memory card having problems.
Yes, yes. And last but not least, one thing that I know a lot of us want to do, especially when we buy those higher-end cameras and it advertises the type of camera we have on the strap, I remove my camera strap. I'm actually looking for a comfortable camera strap that I can wear around my neck if I choose to, but I mainly use resources like the Black Rapid straps that we have out there and whatnot. But I don't think that a camera manufacturer right now really cares about making a comfortable camera strap that's not going to get in my way when I'm shooting photos.
Yes. And again, another crazy thing that they do, $3,000, $7,000 camera, and the camera strap is like slinging razor blades on your neck. It feels awful. Those things are dangerous. You got to watch out for those camera straps. I have nightmares. They're horrible. So, in fact, I don't shoot with any strap. Every once in a while, I'll put on a Black Rapid strap, but I don't know. I always have my tripod plate on, and I know there are a couple workarounds, but I just go strapless. I don't know. But then again, you guys know how I am on gear, so maybe it's not wise to follow my example.
And if you want to be poked in the back with porcupine prills like you were describing with the camera strap, then go ahead and wear it. You know,
it's fine. No problem.
Yeah.
We'll come to your funeral. All right. Well, those are some tips on setting up your camera. So if you haven't set up those things and you have a more advanced camera, you know, check and see what you got. Even if you have a basic camera, a lot of those things you can set up. So if you've never, you know, really dug into the menu of your camera, next time your wife's watching a chick flick, you know, I'll be like, oh yeah, I'll watch it with you. I'll just bring my camera with you. Or women, I guess, next time your husband wants to watch a horror flick, you can do the same. Anyway, thank you for joining us on the podcast, episode 99. We'll have to put something together big for 100.
Yeah, it'll have to be really big, really exciting, and we'll have to take it over the top like we can definitely aim to do. I think that we can definitely impress the audience with what we have up our sleeves. We'll pull something together. We're always good at doing something like that.
Do you know what would be awesome in an audio podcast? Fireworks.
There you go.
Everybody would just love them, and we can just tell you how beautiful they are. All right, thanks for joining us in this episode, and we'll see you in the next one.
Thanks. Cheers.